I'm Peter Suderman, and this is The Reason Podcast. For most of its existence, Backpage.com was mired in legal and political controversy. The website, which hosted online classified ads, much like Craigslist, was accused of facilitating child sex trafficking and was targeted by state attorneys general who said Backpage exploited women and children. Founders Michael Lacey and James Larkin were hauled in front of the Senate, where an official report claimed they knowingly facilitated the criminal sex trafficking of vulnerable women and young girls. Eventually, federal agents shut down the website and raided their homes. The founders are now forced to wear ankle bracelets and prohibited from leaving Maricopa County, where they await a 2020 trial. But as it turns out, the government's case was built on bad faith and bogus arguments. As Reason's Elizabeth Nolan Brown reported, a pair of secret government memos from 2012 and 2013 undermine nearly every aspect of the case against Backpage and its founders. Brown joins me today to talk about the case against Backpage, the memos, and what this means for the ongoing legal and political arguments around sex trafficking and online speech. Liz, thanks for joining me.
Hi.
So you've been covering this case for a long time, and there are an awful lot of details. So to start, I just want to catch us up a little bit. What was Backpage.com, and why did it attract so much attention from state and federal law enforcement authorities?
The very short answer is that it was a classified ad site, like classified ads, the kind of things that used to appear in the back of newspapers all the time, advertising jobs and houses for rent, and someone has a couch for sale or a car for sale. And they often, in print newspapers, became known for some of them in the back, especially the back page of various alternative weekly newspapers and things like that, and then even regular newspapers having adult ads, which were, you know, things for escorts and, you know, independent strippers and back then phone sex lines and things like that. The people who started Backpage, Michael Lacey and James Larkin, they had a bunch of newspapers. They had these classified ads in the back of their newspapers. When Craigslist started offering free classified ads online and just sort of decimated this major source of revenue for all sorts of print publications and newspapers, Lacey and Larkin said, okay, we're going to start this website that offers its own free online classified ads so that it can compete with Craigslist. And they originally launched it in the cities that they had newspapers in. And it eventually became a thing with, different pages for cities all over the world.
It was an extension of their
newspaper.
Alt-weekly newspaper business.
Yes.
And it was really just an online hub for doing the same thing they'd been doing since the 1970s, right?
Right. I mean, people hear a lot about this site and make it sound like there was some sort of crazy setup to it even. And it looks like any other site that people are so familiar with that's an online marketplace where, you know, you create an account just by giving your name and email address, you can post an ad, you can respond to an ad, things like that. So it was a user-generated marketplace for, all sorts of things. And just like in the newspapers, the website Backpage.com had for each city, gigs and services and houses for rent. And then it had the adult section or the adult services section, it was called, I think. And, within that, there were different categories like escorts, strippers, fetish and whatever. And it also had personals, which was just like dating, a site for just like dating ads and stuff like that.
And it was too. The adult section and the personals that attracted the negative attention from state AGs, from Congress, from a lot of other folks. Tell me a little bit about why they were so focused on Backpage and on these ads.
Yeah, this was kind of an extension of, the sort of thing that had been happening where there was a lot of, some of it realistic and some of it super panicky, concerned about pornography on the internet, and then especially pornography featuring underage people on the internet. And sort of an extension of that came about when you started seeing more social media, which includes classified ad sites as well as things, like Twitter and Facebook and all that stuff that's more people-powered media. So when classified ads like that started coming up, you started seeing sex workers using them all the time, sex workers being adults who are involved in, some legal things like stripping and webcamming and porn, and some, illegal things like prostitution.
So there was prostitution ads on these sites, right?
I mean, yes. So here's the thing, is that you had to, you couldn't say that they were prostitution ads. They explicitly made people sign a thing saying you weren't advertising for prostitution. They didn't let people, neither Craigslist nor Backpage or anything, let people say, I am having sex for money, here's how much it is, whatever. That there were all these different processes that, filtered out things like that. So people could advertise there. They had to use sort of coded terms.
But they weren't targeted. Backpage was not targeted primarily because it was facilitating adult prostitution. right? The case against them was that they were, in the words of Kamala Harris and Cindy McCain, they were selling children.
Right.
And this was really where the case kind of evolved out of what became a national panic over the last decade or so about child sex trafficking. And Backpage was really at the center of that. And the case against them was framed in terms of these people are knowingly facilitating, aiding, and encouraging the selling of children for sexual purposes.
Right. That was 100% how it was framed. They started going after Craigslist, and then Craigslist removed this heading that said adults on its thing. It still had personals. It still had all the ads, but it didn't have an ad section explicitly that said adults. So then they started going after Backpage. And they framed it, even though there were obviously some groups involved that are opposed to all prostitution and just think, you know, adults in general shouldn't be doing this, or some decency groups that just think in general this sort of content for hookups and whatever shouldn't be online. But the way this was always framed was, yes, that they were selling children, that we needed to shut down Backpage and maybe change a whole lot of laws about the internet in order to, you know, combat this sort of thing.
And so the upshot of this was that after really quite a lot of legal attacks against them on various fronts in different states, you know, you had state AGs going after them. And then eventually the federal government shut Backpage down. The homes of the founders, Michael Lacey and James Larkin, were raided. And now these guys are confined to Maricopa County, where they live, while they are awaiting trial next year. And they've got to wear ankle bracelets. They're paying a big personal price for this. But the memos that you have recently published here and recently written about, the memos reveal that the case against them is just flat out wrong. Tell us a little bit about what these memos reveal and why they're important.
These memos, I was really excited to see these memos because they say pretty much the exact opposite of everything that, you know, authorities from politicians to people in, you know, national law enforcement and things like that have been saying for years and years.
So start, just back up a little bit. Who wrote these memos and when?
Right, that's probably important to tell you guys. These memos were written by U.S. attorneys, so federal prosecutors, in Washington State in 2012 and 2013. And the first ones was written at the start of this investigation that the U.S. attorneys, these prosecutors in Washington, were doing into Backpage. And they said, you know, we're going to start this investigation. Here's a little bit of preliminary research that we've done. And they presented that. And then in the interim between that memo, which was April 2012, and the next one, which was written in January 2013, they conducted a lot of investigation. They said they poured over more than 100,000 different, you know, Backpage documents. They got grand jury testimony from employees and from other people that were involved with the site. They got a lot of
interviews. So these memos were the result of extensive investigations.
Yes.
This was not some preliminary assessment in which they hadn't started the work. This was the conclusion, maybe not the final conclusion, but this was a conclusion the initial work that had been done to investigate Backpage. And what were the conclusions?
Their conclusions were that they should not prosecute them for any of the things they were thinking, not under the statutes against child sex trafficking, not under the statutes that would be allowed to get them for knowingly facilitating adult prostitution, which, even though it's not a federal crime, you know, if you facilitate it across the internet, you get some commerce clause things, or you cross straight lines, you get some blah, blah, blah. So they said they did not think they should do either of those things. And the reason was because they had not found any evidence that Backpage was knowingly facilitating either child sex trafficking or even illegal prostitution. Just to, you know, read just one quote that I think is especially sort of sums this up. This is from the 2013 one, so the one after they'd done the huge investigation. At the outset of this investigation, it was anticipated that we would find evidence of candid discussions amongst Backpage principals about the use of this site for juvenile prostitution, which could be used as admissions of criminal conduct. It was also anticipated that we would find numerous instances where Backpage learned that a site user was a juvenile prostitute, and Backpage callously continued to post advertisements for her. To date, the investigation has revealed neither. And, you know, it goes on and on and on like that. You know, witnesses have consistently testified that Backpage was making substantial efforts to prevent criminal conduct on its site, that it was coordinating with the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and conducting its business in accordance with legal advice. They found no compelling evidence of criminal intent or no pattern of reckless conduct regarding minors, and revealed a strong economic incentive for Backpage to rid its site of juvenile prostitution.
So the prosecutors went into this case thinking that they would find internal communications in which, behind the scenes, people who worked at Backpage would basically just say, well, of course we know that what we are doing here is facilitating child sex trafficking. That's obviously what business we're in. And in fact, they found—
Or that they would talk about, how we need to make sure that they don't know that this is secretly getting through and whatever. And, you know, they talked to just these— this was at the time when, you know, it had been owned by Village Voice Media, and it was in the time of some selling it between the owners. So
there's a lot of kind of corporate ownership intrigue in the background that kind of underlies a lot of this story.
Right. So there were, I guess, like several people who were big people in business and philanthropy, and I forget all their names exactly, but they were maybe thinking about buying it. So they interviewed all of them too, thinking that, like, you know, in private business discussion, and they had all backed out of buying it too, because they said they were worried. So they thought, aha, you know, if we talk to them, surely they'll say, like, yes, at some point they said to us, at least that they know that, you know, this is for adult prostitution. And they still said no. You know, after they talked to all these different dozens of people, they still didn't get anybody who said anything like that.
So their investigation did not live up to their expectation that they would find hidden admissions of criminality. And not only that, it actually found that Backpage was quite cooperative with law enforcement and served as a useful tool for law enforcement who were trying to stop sex trafficking and predatory behavior. And so this is, I think, I mean, one of the quotes that you report on here is that it was their assessment that, quote, Backpage genuinely wanted to get child prostitution off of its site, and then that they had also an economic incentive to do so.
They also, just one more, I think, quote that sums up, the Innocence Lost Task Force. It's the big thing that's been going on since the start of this century, trying to stop underage prostitution. It's the one that does Operation Cross Country, which is this big thing we've written about a lot, which is basically an FBI-led prostitution sting around the country, but ostensibly to, you know, find and save child sex trafficking victims. So that's their big thing. And they said, information provided to us by this FBI agent who was ahead of the task force and other members of the Innocence Lost Task Force confirmed that, unlike virtually every other website that is used for prostitution and sex trafficking, Backpage is remarkably responsive to law enforcement requests and often takes proactive steps to assist in investigations. And they also have the head of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children saying the same thing, that more than any other site on the internet, they were cooperative. They sent, you know, if there was a child situation, they would send the records and the subpoenas and take down the ads within the hour, all this stuff. So it was just, again and again, you have all these different people saying, yeah, that not only were they not intentionally trying to do this, but that they were helping out with law enforcement and, you know, the Runaway Children's Group and all this stuff more than any other site that had adult ads or had sort of classified ads in general.
If the federal government believed, as this memo suggests, or understood that Backpage was uniquely helpful in trying to stop abusive online behavior, trying to stop sex trafficking, how did we end up then with this narrative that we have now, you know, where we've basically gone from, in this memo, these memos in 2012 and 2013, the clear conclusion is that, you know, Backpage was actively helping law enforcement track down predators and stop abusive behavior. And the narrative now is that Lacey Larkin and Backpage were selling children and were engaged in commercial exploitation of women and young girls. How did that narrative come about, given this set of conclusions?
Okay, well, first I'll tell you how it did not come about, which is that it's not like all of a sudden after 2013, things at Backpage started getting wildly different and all the stuff that we're hearing about since then has now been new conduct that they might not have found in this thing. It's also not like there was a ton of wildly different information that came out in subsequent investigations, and now we're just talking about that. As I, you know, say in my story, a lot of the stuff that winds up in the Senate report, that winds up even in the current criminal charges against them, is stuff that was discovered during these initial investigations. And Lacey and Larkin, two of the people arrested, sold the company in 2015. Just a whole lot of the stuff covers this period that was already being investigated when we're doing that. So I think that's important to make clear, is that, you know, we didn't get some huge new bombshell information. I mean, the Senate report goes into so much detail about the way they filter ads, and they try to make that sound very nefarious. But if you look at these memos, you know, it goes in depth into all of that filtering process that, you know, the Senate subpoenaed tons and tons of documents to, and they compelled all this information, and they said that, you know, we figured this out. They said after their year and a half long special investigation, you know, we figured all this stuff out about filtering because of that. And it's like, no, you didn't. They knew this back in 2013. It says in these memos. I mean, not every single thing, but like the vast majority, the framework of it. And as the Senate even admitted, it was this, you know, 2010 to 2012 period, which is when Craigslist shut its adult ads and a lot of influx over to Backpage started coming. And so that was the period that I think had the most iffy moderation, where, you know, Congress sort of was not happy with the way they were moderating ads. And I'm not saying that they always, you know, always made the best decisions with how to, I mean, it's all very complicated and things like that. But, you know, the laxer they were was in that period that was a long time ago before we saw this. Congress even admitted that, you know, after that, they got stricter with their standards. They were reporting more and more people. You know, they said that anyone who looked under age 21, they had their moderators flag it for Backpage staff, and then they would, you know, look for it and submit it to, you know, so they could run their numbers, run it against missing children's databases.
Let's like talk that. A little bit about the moderation, because one of the things that comes up in these memos is the notion that actually it's really hard to do the kind of moderation that Backpage was expected to do, that a lot of politicians were like, well, why aren't you doing this? And they talk about, well, look, it's difficult to tell based on images, based on ads, who is engaged in behavior that is illegal or suspect in some way. Talk a little bit about how the memos describe the challenges of doing the kinds of moderation that a lot of politicians, a lot of Backpage's critics said, well, you should, of course, be doing this.
Right. You had a lot of Backpage critics, you know, try to say that, okay, I mean, some of the more temperate criticisms were say like, okay, well, even if they're not knowingly, you know, trying to be child sex slavers, like they're not doing all that they can. They are not. And in fact, they're like uniquely negligent. Like, sure, maybe they're not only not doing all they can, but they are like uniquely negligent at this stuff. And yes, you have in these memos them saying that, you know, the way that they did age verification, which is, you know, just to say you have to say that you're over 18 and whatever. I mean, there is not. That was standard across the internet and still is. It's not like Backpage didn't do, you know, anything like that. They did, you know, start requiring a credit card, which was at the request of the National Association of Attorneys General, because they said that would not only create a paper trail should anything bad happen, but, you know, make minors less likely to be able to post to the adult ed section because they're less likely to have credit cards. I mean, obviously, then the memos even say, well, with prepaid cards, that hadn't exactly worked out like they thought. But they say over and over again that, you know, even trained investigators can't tell just from pictures, especially most of these pictures are only a partial, you know, sort of picture or something. You know, they're not nude photos, but maybe suggestive photos of, you know, the body without the face, because, you know, which is important. It's not just to try and hide because you're a child or you're a sex trafficker. I mean, sex workers themselves face so much stigma, and even if they're doing legal work, that they don't want to put their faces out there. So,
a lot of
these
don't have it. But the other thing here that stood out to me was that it wasn't just sex workers. And there was this assumption going in that everyone who was advertising in the adult section was selling sex somehow or another.
Yes.
And it's almost funny in reading the memo to see where they're like, actually, some of these escorts were just escorts. They provided companionship.
Or where they said, they said some of them were massages, some of them were porn, you know, but this was legal. There's this whole section, in the memo where they go and they say, you know, we thought that anytime you saw a woman posting sexually suggestive photos or language on the internet, it must be for illegal sex. But we've actually learned from talking to many people and studying the market and blah, 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 that like it could be any number of legal industries, and that in fact there are, I mean, this isn't a myth. There are very much sex workers who do, you know, sensual massage and don't do full sex. You know, there are very much people who go on all these, and it kind of shows you how dumb our line is between what we criminalize and don't, but the agents even say, or the attorneys even say, yes, we thought everything on the site in the adult section was going to be horrible illicit exploitation, and it turns out not only that, but it's not even illegal, a lot of it.
They're like naively shocked to learn that in fact there are,
and sometimes people
legal
are just hooking
services
up. They're like,
that you
sometimes
can
it's just
advertise.
Even regular sex, you know, not even commercial sex, that they'd have scantily clad pictures. It's like, oh buddy, have you ever been on Tinder or whatever, but.
So I do want to also talk a little bit. I want to ask you about the effect that the crusade against Backpage has had against women, and in particular against sex workers, women who advertise their services on Backpage. It really seems like, you know, we've talked a little bit about how Backpage was actively trying to help law enforcement weed out the bad actors. And that seems like a good thing. It gave it gave law enforcement access to data. It gave there was a good working relationship there. But the existence of Backpage, independent of that, was also a valuable thing for these women.
Right. I mean, just at large, you know, advertising, online advertising, as you will hear sex workers across so many different groups and, you know, cultures say, has just been such a boon for, you know, their ability to work independently, to be able to find clients on their own without having to rely on middlemen and that are going to take their money and possibly be abusive, with, you know, letting them screen clients, you not have to just, you know, you think of the old ways of just getting into a car or getting a phone call or whatever. You know, you can email back and forth with someone, you can demand their identification, and many sex workers do, you know, and clients are willing to do that because, you know, they're, a lot of them who meet with sex workers regularly, like, realize that this is what's important to keep people safe. So you could do all of that. And obviously Backpage wasn't the only site on the internet that sex workers advertise on. There's so many, but it was a big one and it was easily accessible and it was a sort of centralized place. So it was good for, like you said, it was good for just sort of sex workers in general to be working independently outside of, you know, traffickers or pimps or whatever. And then also good because it was, you know, working with law enforcement. I say this in the article too, but since 2017, and Backpage shut its adult ad section then, even though it still, you know, had the other parts up. And then in 2018, it was shut down. They passed this internet law, FOSTA. I'll come back to that one second. But since all this stuff happened, you see cops across the country talking about how it's harder for them to find, you know, teen runaways and things like that. And it's harder for them to prosecute sex traffickers and all this stuff now that Backpage and some other sites that were similar have been taken down. And it's such a trope that it actually made it on Law & Order SVU. They had the cops on there talking about how now they couldn't find anybody because Backpage was down. And that's not, you know, some people will say that's just because, oh, well, then it must be because now they're all, you know, nobody's getting hurt because Backpage is up. But of course, I mean, there's been studies, there's the same amount of ads on the internet, they're just elsewhere. A lot of cops are saying, you know, street-based prostitution has gone up. It's not like suddenly it's just disappeared. It's just that all these other ways are not proactively reporting to law enforcement. They're not handing over their records and things like that.
It's been driven underground, right, and thus made more dangerous.
Right. And less likely to, when it does happen, to be able to be, you know, bring to justice.
So I have had the privilege of editing a lot of your work on Backpage and
thank
all these
God.
Things.
I should see them before they go to Peter sometimes.
they're always fantastic, and I enjoy reading them, and I'm serious about that. And one of the things that has really struck out to me about your work is that you have, whenever you've covered Backpage, whenever you've covered some of these issues, you've always tried to sort of draw out the implications for sex workers and for the women whose lives are supposedly what's at stake here and are supposedly the kind of the central subject. And all of the crusaders who hate Backpage and who hate Lacey and Larkin are will say, you know, we're doing this because we don't want women to be exploited and hurt. And you have made what I think is a very compelling case consistently over time that these women are in fact hurt by these prosecutions and by these crusades. Do Backpage's critics ever really grapple with this or acknowledge it? And if so, how do they defend some of these crusades against online sex work ads, given that you even have law enforcement here pretty much saying it's easier to take out the bad actors if a service like Backpage, if Backpage itself exists?
Right. No. I don't think they do grapple with it. And which is to say that, you know, there are a lot of social services groups that work with, you know, sex trafficking survivors, child victims, or, you know, when I say child, I mean, almost always we're talking teenagers and usually older teenagers. But so I hate to use their language, which sort of,
I mean, they're still minors.
Right. They are still minors. But I try to say minors or teenagers or things
right.
like that, because you say child.
A lot of the kind of talk about this right. conjures up images of girls who are 6 or 8 or right. 9 years old. And while that's not never been the case, right. it is much more frequently to be minor teenagers.
Right. And so, you know, you have the people who are working with them that are not ideological, who will say all the things that, you know, that I'm saying, that sex workers are saying, that criminal justice advocates and defense attorneys and things like that are saying, you know, harm reduction. You know, they'll say pretty much the same thing, you know, more or less about whether about Backpage specifically or internet ads in general and things like that. They agree. And also, I mean, the local cops, even like local police, not the ones who are making the big national press announcements and things like that, but also say the same sort of thing about it being a partner. The groups that are the nonprofit groups that really say you cannot reason with them on this are the ones that tend to get in front of all the media and tend to have the most funding and tend to get called before congressional testimonies. And if you look at all their mission statements, their missions are not just to help exploited minors. Their missions are usually to stop all sort of sex work or to stop. I mean, one of the groups is like trying to get Cosmo banned from grocery store shelves also because that exploits women and children. It's this combination of sort of old school Christian, you know, moral crusaders against sexuality being visible at all. And this, you know, rad femme leftist feminist critique of, you know, no woman can ever make a choice to do any sort of, you know, sexual thing without it being, you know, the patriarchy or whatever. So, I mean, most of the groups that are really getting to define this conversation are groups that pretend that they're, and I'm not saying that they're not interested in, you know, nobody wants to see children exploited. I'm sure they generally do mean that, but they're not just trying to stop that. And that's why they will just not acknowledge you when you give them cold hard facts like this. It's just like, they just won't even acknowledge it because that would, then they'd have to admit that, yeah, actually we are trying to go after all prostitution or all sex work or even all adult sexuality online.
The definition of exploitation is, I think, kind of a big open question here in these cases,
right.
And what counts and what
right.
doesn't.
And yeah, that gives them wiggle room.
It seems as if there's a sort of a definition creep where
right.
they are, where in many cases they're talking about women who are not minors, who are adults, who have chosen to engage in sex work, chosen to advertise, and in fact would prefer to do so over using a platform like Backpage. And so, you know, how do you think about the question of exploitation? What counts? What doesn't? Is there anything to the argument, in your opinion, that, well, sure, these people may be choosing to do this, but in some sense they are pushed. In some sense, the world that we live in has, there's a kind of inherent exploitation built into that. How do you kind of wrestle with that, especially given the sort of the delicacy and, let's say, major parts of our culture really find sex work, find prostitution, whether it's consenting or not, quite offensive and think that it just shouldn't exist in the world. How do you sort of think through some of the sort of the moral issues surrounding what goes on here?
I mean, I think it's a silly way to think about things to say that, you know, women think they're choosing this and aren't because of blah, 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 society, patriarchy, culture. That's a sort of terrible, you know, Marxist false consciousness thing that denies women's agency. And I have no time for that, for arguing with that. If that's the kind of thing you think, it's just a whole worldview that's just so almost impenetrable.
It's sort of two worldviews because, as you noted, it exists on both the sort of very socially conservative
right.
and in parts of the very radical left.
Yes. The ones who, on both sides, though, the ones who aren't, you know, super ideological activists, and this is, you know, anybody, like you were saying, when we talk more about the people who are just worried that prostitution is inherently exploitative or immoral or whatever, things like that, you know, I think that the best argument to always go for is the harm reduction thing. And I mean, when watching people in the sex worker community and the criminal justice reform community talk about this has, like, informed the way I talk about it so much, which is just, even if, you know, these people are, even if you would prefer this not to happen, like, it is happening, and we want to make sure that the people who are involved in it, first and foremost, are not being, you know, raped and killed and things like
yeah.
that, then let's worry about saving their souls, right? Like, then let's worry about, you know, whether or not they're feeling totally empowered by their work. Like, let's make sure that they have their material needs met, things like that. Because you're not going to ever get people out of this just based on, you know, them having, they still need to eat, they still need to live, you know, you can't just get out of it on morality or feminist theory alone, I think.
So your argument is this may be, we may disagree about whether this is moral, about whether this is good for society or
right.
fine for society or not, but these are people who are being hurt, and criminalizing and driving their activities underground hurts them even more and ensures that more of them will be hurt than
right.
a more legal and transparent
right. And there are also
kind of
just specific ways this is true, you know, and examples you can go into, but yes, yeah.
And Backpage was
yes.
not a way of engaging in necessarily in illegal acts legally. It didn't make
yeah.
anything legal, but what it did was provide an above ground platform for some of these services to take place in ways that were at least a little less dangerous for the people who were doing them, right?
Yes, yeah.
So I also want to talk about, and let's switch gears here just a little bit. The other thing that consistently comes out in your work that you always pay attention to is that this is not just about Lacey and Larkin and Backpage or even just about sex work. It's also about online speech. And
it's about the whole internet.
Right. It is about the whole internet. So this is something I want you to just sort of tell me a little bit about how their case relates to the fight we are having now kind of all over Washington about big tech and Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act of 1996, which I promise these things are all connected. And you, I think, have done better work than anybody at showing us how.
Yeah. So, sorry, this is kind of, it's kind of a weird topic. But right now, like as Peter said, there's this huge push right now to rein in big tech, to modify Section 230. The first I started hearing, and the reason I've been writing about this now across the board in all sorts of contexts, but the reason
let's just go back up just a little bit. What's Section 230 and why does it matter?
Section 230, says that users of internet interactive computer services, so everything from, your Backpage to your Facebook to your WordPress site to whatever, are not to be treated the same as the services themselves. So, if you tweet something and it ends up being defamatory, Twitter is not going to be liable for that. If, someone posts some extreme content that ends up, and they end up being a shooter or a terrorist or something, the place that the website that hosted the cloud company that hosted their website is not going to be held liable
for
that.
And it specifically says that Twitter or Facebook or Backpage, when it still existed, it specifically says that those sites can engage in some amount of moderation in order to try to get stuff that they don't want to see on their sites off of those sites.
Yeah, good faith, voluntary efforts to moderate, illegal, illicit, or just otherwise objectionable content is fine. And then the reason it was passed was because before that, because of the way First Amendment law is, web providers thought that if they took any sort of filtering or moderation to their sites, if they had any notice that things were going on and tried to get out the bad stuff, that would put them in greater legal jeopardy, which was true and would be true without Section 230. So, they were right, and they were just sort of not letting anything go, or they were getting sued. And so they were like, okay, we don't want them to just let everything go. We want them to do some moderation. So this will let sites do some moderation without then worrying that they're going to be held liable as the speaker of all of this stuff that everybody is saying on their sites.
And this goes back to what we were talking about earlier, where Backpage was engaged in moderation and Backpage was actively trying to get illegal activity off of their site. And that is something that does not increase their liability.
Right, which is why they, won again and again in court because of Section 230. Yeah, is why they were able to win and again against these people who were, trying to say that they were liable for any bad thing that was, happened after people met up on the site.
So you mentioned the whole internet being kind of being at risk here.
Yeah.
Talk me through that and tell me why Backpage is the canary in the coal mine, the example that we should be paying attention to when we're thinking about why Section 230 is important and when we're thinking about why Section 230 is in some ways the key, the backbone to preserving free speech online.
Right. So Section 230, as you just said, it's the key, it's the backbone, it's, it's the most important law for, protecting free speech and freedom of thought on the internet. And so obviously a lot of politicians and authorities hate it. They wish that they or state attorneys general or whoever could, have more control over these internet companies, have more control what all of us say on them, which without Section 230, they would be able to do. There'd be much more ability to both punish tech companies themselves directly with either criminal charges or civil penalties and, massive fines and things like that, or to make them so scared of that they would take extreme, moderation practices, that they would really cut down on letting all users speak because it would just be too dangerous to have anything that might be regarded as even slightly controversial out there. So that's, that's what would happen without Section 230. That's why people don't like it.
And there have already been small modifications, if I understand correctly, to how 230 works.
Yes. So last year, FOSTA, the law that was, sold as a way to stop sex trafficking, modified Section 230.
Sold as a way to stop sex trafficking very much by talking about
Backpage nonstop.
Backpage was the central example in why that law needed to be passed.
And several years before,
people saying that
law needed to be passed. As early as 2014, you have people in Congress introducing laws to amend Section 230. They say specifically so they can go after Backpage. So they keep saying, we need to do this, we need to do this. Now we've seen since that time, they're all of a sudden they have all these new reasons that they need to go after it. Surprise, surprise. Which is what, I expected, what, people who were paying attention expected, because you could very much see that politicians and, attorneys general and stuff they want this free speech promoting law to be dead. They needed to sort of poke holes in it. They knew that there was going to be a huge pushback from tech companies and from all sorts of people if they just sort of start going after it. I mean, now I think that the tech lash is the right for it. But, back in 2010, 11, 12, they didn't have the sort of political will to just sort of go after it by targeting Facebook or Twitter or whatever. So, you know, they start going after Craigslist and then Backpage and saying that they're doing it to stop either just, you know, sex ads in general or child sex ads and things like that, so that nobody really pays attention. And they, you know, they tried in 2014, they tried with the 2015 Save Act. They finally eventually in 2018 got FOSTA passed that did amend it based on this small grounds that, you know, we're doing this because we need to stop, allegedly this is going to help stop child sex trafficking, and you know, it won't, but that's a whole other story. But I think it's just, it's really interesting to note that they, I think they really did take Backpage and take sex workers and use them as a test case and see what would we have to do to be able to, you know, garner the political will to be able to do this. And then as soon as they did, they've been introducing all these new bills to pass it, to amend it or abolish it based on all these other things, from alleged conservative bias on Twitter to, you know, hate speech to just every and anything under the sun that people think is bad. Is now being like, well, we need to get rid of Section 230 because this is sometimes happening and it's sometimes brokered through the internet. And, you know, they say that this will stop it when really it'll just sort of let them crack down on speech in general.
So the legal and political case against Backpage is the legal and political case against the internet as we know it now.
That I mean, as the, is, yeah, the, against the social internet. It really sort of is.
That is really kind of frightening. Final question for you here. When you saw these memos, they validated an awful lot of what you have been writing and reporting and arguing for years now. What did you think? What was your first thought? And what do you think the most important thing about these memos is for someone who has not been following all of the ins and outs? What should they come away from the publication of these memos understanding?
I mean, for someone who's not following the ins and outs, I think the most important basic thing here is all the things we were talking about in the beginning, that these memos show that after extensive investigation, federal prosecutors, who then, from that point forward, only publicly said the opposite, are saying, you know, we think that they are doing better than any other site at trying to stop this. We think they are very helpful. We think they are not negligent. We don't think they are intentional. We think that they are, you know, a boon to helping us try and stop exploitation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. I think that's the most important takeaway, and then knowing that, you know, that they still just pursued this anyways, even though they said that. To me, though, the thing that just jumped out as the craziest, I mean, I was obviously excited to see that, because, but, you know, that's what I thought was true. It validates it. But I also have, you know, a pretty good knowledge of what was in. I think I'd just been reading the indictments against them, or the new indictment against them. And, you know, I've read the when Kamala Harris had them arrested, I've read all those indictments. I've read all this stuff for the past 2 years. And was to look at these, there's the parts of the memo where they say, okay, we should not go after them. But if we want to, here are the elements that would stand in the way, and here are the elements that we would have to prove, and here's what would be the problem with that, and here's how maybe we could go about getting that if we could get this to happen. And some of that stuff was about money and credit cards and blah, blah, blah. And you look at the next few years, and they systematically, someone in law enforcement or in the federal government, did something so that Backpage had no choice but to switch and do something in that direction, like stop, you know, getting credit cards and do Bitcoin or blah, blah, blah. There's all these different things, but they had no choice but to do that, or they were doing it to help out because government had asked them to. And then they have taken those things, and those are now the things that are making up the criminal indictment against them. And that's what's so crazy to me, is that they didn't just ignore the recommendation and decide to go through with this anyways. They actually then, over years and over, you know, a whole bunch of different things, sort of set the conditions that would be necessary to get this money laundering charge that they're now trying to get them on.
So the government pursued a case they knew was based on a bogus argument,
yes,
destroyed two men's lives in the process, made life worse for the women they said they were trying to help.
And may destroy the internet.
Liz, thank you so much for talking with us. I'm sorry we have to go out on that note, but that appears to be where we are. Your reporting on this has been excellent. I'm Peter Suderman, and
thank you,
this
Peter.
Is The Reason Podcast. Thanks for listening.